Obesity has been rising in Maine, what that means for the state, and how to reverse things. According to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Maine is the most obese state in New England. The most recent analysis shows that 30% of adults in Maine are categorized as obese. That is, they have a BMI of 30 or more. Public health officials link obesity with many other problems, including diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, several types of cancer, sleep apnea, and even mental health problems. A number of agencies and community organizations are working together to try to help people combat obesity, but it's a complicated issue, especially in rural Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll look at some of the efforts underway and we'll discuss the latest research. What's behind the obesity epidemic? What needs to happen next? And what can individuals do to lose weight? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. 2 out of 3 adults are overweight or obese in Maine. If you made a New Year's resolution to lose weight or eat better, you are not alone. That tops the list of resolutions among Americans every year. But why is obesity such a difficult problem, and what can be done to help both individuals or entire communities? Well, that's the subject of our show today. Joining me in our studio, Dr. Dervilla McCann. She is Chief of Population Health for Central Maine Healthcare. Aaron Gay is Executive Director of Healthy Androscoggin. And Dr. Peter Ammon is a family practice physician with Scarborough Family Medicine and Maine Medical Partners and physician advisor to the Let's Go program. He's also a delegate for the American Board of Obesity Medicine. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you or someone you know struggle with obesity, or have you had success at keeping weight off? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you all, and welcome back to a couple of you. I'll start with you, Dr. Ammon. Give us a characterize how big of a problem this is in Maine.
So Maine is not unique throughout New England or other states in the country in that, as you mentioned, we have an enormous burden of overweight and obesity in the state. About a third of the people in our state are overweight and another third are obese. As people get larger, there's an increased risk of multiple medical issues, including diabetes and heart disease, depression and arthritis. Even certain cancers can be increased risk. Folks who carry extra weight have a decreased quality of life compared to folks who have normal weights. A lot of comorbidities, as I mentioned, and complications from that weight.
Okay. When you say an increase, I always wonder when there's an increased risk. Are we talking about 5% increased risk? Or are we talking 50%, 75% increase?
Pretty significant. So most of the risks for various diseases are proportional to the weight. So, you know, as someone gets larger, their risk goes up sometimes exponentially with regard to depending on what you're talking about.
All right. Dervilla, why is it worse in rural areas?
Well, there's a correlation between socioeconomic status. Sometimes there's a lack of access to good medical care. It's a medical access is an increased burden for rural communities. There's sometimes less to do. There's an isolation that comes sometimes with living in a rural area with limited activities, perhaps more tendency to spend one's time, and you have ample opportunities to spend great quality time sitting down, and that, you know, especially now with access to television, social media, your smartphone, et cetera. So in cold climates, particularly like ours in Maine, and when it's very difficult, I mean, you risk your life sometimes just stepping outside your home.
So. Right. And I think it's, and Aaron, I'll bring you into the conversation. I think that this is especially appropriate on a day like today. It is icy out there. And most people are going to get home from work and it's going to be icy and dark outside. Not exactly the conditions to go on a walk before dinner or after dinner. Is that one of the big problems here? Is that, you know, if you're not living right down the street from a YMCA, it's hard to get some exercise in Maine in the winter.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the unique challenges that we have here in Maine. And that's why folks across the state, like Healthy Androscoggin, where I work, are trying to connect folks to the opportunities that we do have, whether they be at a YMCA or if your local school maybe opens up the gym for walking in the evening. Or sometimes we just have to get more creative as well. I've got a couple of little kids, and we like to have evening dance parties in our kitchen because that's what's available to us. But I think we also have to kind of embrace winter as well and try to find those opportunities where we can get outside and enjoy the snow when we can. Of course, this winter has been particularly difficult in that way, but we just have to get a little more creative.
All right. Peter, let's talk about how we got here. Throughout my entire lifetime, there have been, I think, changing recommendations on what people ought to be eating, what's good for them. Sometimes conflicting. We went through the high-carb, low-fat era. Now we're into the certain fats are good for you era. There is one of the recent things I heard is it's really terrific if you can go 12 hours without eating, which conflicts with the eat a little bit all the time to fuel your system. Did all of that add up to where we are today, or do you think it's something else?
So it's a complicated issue. So back in 1950, about 10% of adults carried extra weight in the form of obesity. Fast forward to 1970s, it was like 15%, and now we're up to 35% and more in certain areas of the state. Certain pockets, certain states are heavier than us. As you mentioned earlier, Maine is the heaviest state in New England. It's a complicated question, and the question is whether it is the overabundance of food choices we have. You know, we can have food anywhere. We can get food at the home improvement store. We can get food at the gas station. We can get food at the drive-in. The food is delicious. It is colorful. It is well advertised. So there's an overabundance of food. People also drink a lot of calories, so sodas and coffee drinks and energy drinks. Those can often have a lot of calories. When we drink a lot of calories, we don't eat any less. So people are drinking and eating a lot more delicious foods. Maybe people have less access to healthier foods like fruits and vegetables. We in Maine, we mentioned already, are often inside for a long period of time. In our childhood and, you know, as we grew up, more and more time spent, you know, sedentary activities on the computer and the laptop, on the watching TV. So a lot of issues that kind of contribute to where we are today.
I'm wondering, though, what we do with this information. I mean, I know that soda companies are selling much less soda than they used to. People, Davila, you're nodding. People know this. People know that sodas contribute. Everybody knows this now, and people are buying less, yet our obesity rates go up. You go into a lot of different restaurants, from Panera to fast food restaurants and to Starbucks, and the calories are on the menu, which is terrific. It helps you make good choices. Yet obesity rates are going up.
That's right. And it's interesting you brought up the whole subject of sugar added or sugary drinks, because we've targeted them a little bit. We've tried in certain states and certain cities have attempted to limit consumption by usually taxing these drinks. But as you mentioned, the consumption of sugar-added beverages has gone down, but the obesity epidemic really hasn't really had a parallel change with the lower consumption of sugary drinks. And there's actually sort of a bit of a backlash now when certain communities are trying to tax these beverages, because singling out one particular added food type or food with added sugar is probably not entirely fair. And more importantly, it doesn't appear to be all that effective. So I think stepping back from just looking at one particular food type as the culprit is probably wise. There are many different diets. You brought up the fact that for decades we've been really promoting a low-fat diet. And then there's all sorts of fascinating diets, even a tapeworm diet and a grapefruit diet and a cabbage soup diet. And the truth of it is, restricting calories, doesn't matter what diet, you're going to lose a little bit of weight. But there does appear to be a shift in opinion now, scientific opinion, about what diet may be more effective, not only to lose the weight, which is relatively hard, but to sustain the weight loss, which is even harder, because we now understand that there are physiologic changes. Your body will change to try to hang on to every fat cell when you're dieting. And so there's a move now to look much more carefully at what we call ketogenic diets, which are the original one was the Atkins diet. It was a relatively high fat, high protein, but very low carb. Now we understand that actually that balance between carbs, protein, and fat is very important. And the ketogenic diet is actually a pretty high fat diet with low protein and low carbohydrates. And we're going to be studying that in the Framingham, in a branch of the Framingham study this summer. We're going to start enrolling patients in, you know, three limbs of a dietary trial looking at the effectiveness of different balances between those three food
groups. Is that going to happen here in Maine?
No, it's going to happen in Framingham, Massachusetts.
Okay, and the Framingham study is the famous study that has long-term
over... The mother of all population studies.
Yeah, nurses, right?
What really started with Framingham was the entire population of Framingham, Massachusetts was noted to not really move. People were born, brought up, lived, married, and stayed their whole lives in Framingham. So it was a very stable population. And so that was the place where we just started looking at the entire population of Framingham, Massachusetts. And it's gone on now. I think we're in our third generation. It's a wonderful study. At the time, it had a lot of really groundbreaking revelations about, for example, the causes of cardiac disease. And we started to understand the role that diabetes and cigarette smoking and cholesterol played. So it's a pretty neat study, and it continues to spawn new work.
I want to ask you, Aaron, about some of the efforts that have gone on in Maine in the last few years. I know that there was a health improvement plan, a Maine State Health Improvement Plan, that was written up in 2013. What has changed in Maine since then? What has worked?
Dr. McCann's looking at me, so I will take that. Well, a couple of things that we've done is really focus on increasing fruits and vegetable consumption among both youth and adults. And we've got a fantastic program that we run statewide, which is called SNAP-Ed. And SNAP-Ed's goal is to provide low-income Mainers with skills and knowledge needed to make healthier food choices with a limited budget, as well as to promote physically active lifestyles. So the SNAP-Ed program is funded through USDA, through the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, used to be known as food stamps, as well as Maine DHHS and University of New England down in Portland is the implementing agency. And UNE contracts with local public health agencies like Healthy Androscoggin, where I work, and we employ 40 nutrition educators across the state to be able to teach the skills that people need. People don't really know how to cook, shop, eat healthy on a budget. And so we really boil down those messages for folks, and we teach classes in all kinds of settings, whether it be a childcare setting or a school setting, after school, a senior site. And it's really just getting back to the basics of finding foods that are good for you and how to prepare them, how to store them.
Does someone need to receive SNAP benefits to qualify for these classes, or can anyone go to one of these classes?
Yeah, they're really for low-income folks, so we try to concentrate the classes in places where, you know, like schools that have high free and reduced lunch rates, for instance. But we do have some classes that are open to all community members. So one example of that would be that we run free grocery store tours in partnership with Hannaford and the Good Shepherd Food Bank. So anybody can from the community can come in, and we take people through the major aisles of the grocery store and point out how to look for fruits and vegetables, how to know if they're ripe, how to find low cost. And then at the end of the class, people are actually given a $10 gift card, and they can use that $10 to buy a healthy meal based on the lessons that they learned through the class. So there's some really great initiatives going on that are standardized across the whole state and then are evaluated for their effectiveness.
All right. Well, Trevilla, you talked a little bit about some research you're embarking on. I want to sort of step back and find out what we have learned. And I want to ask, Peter, what do we know about the genetic component of obesity, and what do we not know?
So there is some genetic component for obesity, but it's generally speaking a small component. So in very rare cases, there are genetic mutations that increase patients' appetites, you know, tremendously. You know, kids are 100 pounds by the time they're three. That's the exception rather than the rule. In most cases, you know, that mom and dad have extra weight, they have habits that cause them to have extra weight. their child has increased risk for having extra aid as well. So, you know, husbands and wives or partners have the same similar body habitus as their partners, as your friends. So you kind of have the same habits, the same exercise habits, the same eating habits, the same restaurant habits, perhaps, as the people around you. So more so than specific your kind of genetics, it's more your environment, who you live with, who you hang out with, who you eat with, who you exercise with, that contributes.
Okay. Why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to lose weight?
Hunger is a pretty intense feeling. I mean, we tend to gain weight as we age, and women in particular have a shift in their body fat distribution. And I'm postmenopausal, and something suddenly happened to me when I was 50, and I've been really focused on, I'm going to have to lose some weight. And it is. I'm here to tell you, as a physician, I know exactly what to do, and it's really hard. And if you let yourself get hungry, just get out of my way, on my way to the refrigerator. It's a very primitive instinct. And as I mentioned earlier, even if you do lose weight, keeping it off is difficult. And we've talked a little bit here today about education and how important it is. And I think keeping the message simple is one important thing to try to do. Basically, if a human being eats 500 calories too much, maybe a chocolate chip cookie or two every single day, they can expect to gain about a pound a week.
Right, 50 pounds a year. And 100 calories is 10 pounds a year.
You bet.
So and 10 years is 100 extra
pounds.
That's
exactly right. So it's a little bit every day really, really mounts up. Similarly, you just have to restrain yourself a little bit every day. If you cut back, if you eat slightly less than you need, 500 calories per day, you can lose a pound a week. And sometimes it's just the little accoutrements that people don't understand, like, you know, the olive oil or the butter or the mayonnaise or the sauce on this or that, that if you just understand a little bit more about the calorie count there, that can be very effective. But it's hard. It's a primitive instinct. And human beings have unlimited storage capacity, so we can just keep packing it on.
I think the hard part about that is it's not just a math equation. So as we diet, as we try to lose weight, our body has a set point that it wants to get back to. As we lose weight, we become hungrier. So the forces that make us want to eat more are more in play. Our metabolisms also slow down. So when people lose weight, they actually everything that we do, just the baseline metabolism slows down. So there are a lot of factors that are constantly kind of interfering with our ability to keep the weight off that we lose in the first place.
And you've been nodding over there, Erin. I wanted to let you jump in.
Yeah, I'd just add that I think as a society, we're so much busier as well. And it takes a while for our bodies to register that we're full. But if we're sort of chowing down just to get to the next place that we have to go, then we're not really in tune with our bodies to know if we're still hungry or not. So we need to kind of slow it down. I'm guilty of eating at my desk at work a lot. My coworkers remind me not to do that. But I think
because you work at Healthy Androscoggin.
I do, right? I've got to live it. But I think, yeah, it's just harder because the pace of life is so much faster these days.
Well, we're talking about obesity on Maine Calling. We do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, there are already a lot of them. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Rooster Brother, roasting coffee since 1987 in downtown Ellsworth. Learn more at roosterbrother.com.
If you turn on a children's TV channel during a commercial break, you'll see ads clearly geared toward boys.
Hot Wheels leading the way!
And very different ads geared toward girls.
Makeup and I'm gonna make you beautiful.
We're not going to be getting her baby dolls and Barbies.
The revolutionary act of trying to raise a child free of gender stereotypes, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Join us for Hidden Brain Sunday morning at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Also this Sunday evening at 6, you can join us for the main event on Maine Public Television. This week, hosts Republican State Senator Roger Cates and former Democratic House Speaker Hannah Pingree talk about the 2018 governor's race, with guests including Maine Public News political correspondent Mal Leary and Portland Press Herald reporter Scott Thistle. That's on the Maine event, Sunday evening at 6 on Maine Public Television.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Obesity. With me in the studio, Aaron Gay, who's Executive Director of Healthy Androscoggin, Peter Ammon with Scarborough Family Medicine and the American Board of Obesity Medicine, and Dervilla McCann, Chief of Population Health for Central Maine Healthcare. We invite you to join the conversation. Our number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I do want to get to all the calls and emails in just a second. But first, it was sort of discouraging what we were talking about before the break, how hard it is. But Dr. Ammon, I have read that even if someone can lose a few pounds, it may have a really remarkable benefit to their health.
Yeah,
is that true?
It absolutely is true. So people want to be, you know, thin. People want to lose 100 pounds. But there's great data to suggest that even losing 3 to 5% of your body weight and keeping that weight off can improve your blood sugars, can improve your blood pressure, can lower your cholesterol. If people are able to lose 5 to 10% of their body weight, so if someone's, for example, 250 pounds, 25 pounds is 10%, people can expect to be able to decrease their medicines at times, and as well as kind of improve their bad cholesterol, improve their triglycerides, improve their blood sugars. So what I often speak to patients is gallons of milk. So people carry around X number of extra gallons of milk. And think of a backpack with 5 gallons of milk extra. And what would you feel just to lose one of those gallons of milk? You know, each gallon of milk you peel off, you're going to feel physically better. You're going to have more energy. You're going to sleep better. And, you know, all of those small incremental changes will improve your health dramatically.
So a gallon of milk is 5 pounds?
8 pounds.
8 pounds. So if you lose 8 pounds, you're losing a gallon of milk.
Right.
How would you like to not have to carry that gallon of milk around every day?
And people can appreciate that analogy.
That is motivational. We'll go to Cheryl calling from Bath. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to address that I've been a member of Overeaters Anonymous for over 30 years. And when I first started, the meetings were a lot bigger and, you know, a lot more people. I see so many heavy people. And I can't believe that OA isn't just packed with hundreds of people at every meeting. I think that people want to do the gastric bypass and everything, and they want to do an easier, softer way. Instead of, no matter what you do, the gastric bypass, you go on a diet, you still have to deal with being a compulsive overeater, which caused your problem in the first place.
Thoughts?
I think what we have here is a great example of the evolving norms of obesity. A lot of people, if you query people today in the United States who are obese, many more of them now say that their weight is just about okay. And there's a movement to reduce the stigmatization of people who are overweight. And I totally appreciate the removal of shaming people and humiliating people about their weight. But what is also happening is obesity is now becoming the normal, and people are getting used to the fact that, well, this is just the way I am, and I think that that's part of the reason that Overeaters Anonymous, the chapter that this caller is talking about, is not as well populated as it was.
Cheryl, tell us about Overeaters Anonymous for people who haven't been there. What's it like to go to a meeting? Do you find it, you've been there a lot of years, you said, so clearly you find it beneficial. I'm sorry, I'm going to have you start over again. Go ahead. We had you potted down.
Sorry. It's based on the 12 steps, like started by Alcoholics Anonymous. Overeaters Anonymous was started in 1960. And it's just the basic 12 steps. You get a sponsor, you start working the steps, you start getting rid of the garbage in your head. And everybody says you have to lose the fat in your head before you lose the fat in your body. And it's a support group because, let's face it, I can talk to somebody. You can talk to somebody if you're a medical person and you have a different perspective. But it's like when Bill W. would go and talk to other drunks and say, I know stuff that you know that other doctors and people don't know. And it's the same way with Overeaters Anonymous. We understand what it's like to use food as a coping mechanism and to be able to learn to make it so you can live your life and it's hard with food. You have to control food. You can't just stop eating.
That's right. Unlike drinking alcohol, you can stop, right, but you can't stop eating.
Right.
Cheryl, well, thank you so much for calling in, and I'm sure there are people in our audience today who will look up a Overeaters Anonymous group because of your call. Thank you so much. We have an email from Andrea. I would love if your guests could talk about gut bacteria's role in obesity. That's something we're learning about now, isn't it?
So it's pretty fascinating that half of our stool is bacteria, like it or not. So there are literally thousands of different types in our gut, which are influenced by what we eat. They're influenced by our environment. They're influenced by use of antibiotics. Very interesting studies in mice that if you transplant the gut bacteria from a thin mouse into an obese mouse, that obese mouse sometimes becomes thin. So there's a huge interplay between the trillions of bacteria in our gut and the hormones that we produce and they produce that can influence our weight.
We'll go to Ann calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Ann. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. Hi. I'd like to mention two public policy issues that contribute to this problem. One is Governor LePage has bragged about how many people he's cut off the food stamp rolls, and at the same time, food banks throughout the state have had, you know, massive numbers of people showing up hungry. And if you have food stamps, you can pick healthy foods. If you're going to the food bank, fresh fruits and vegetables and lean proteins are harder to find. The other thing I wanted to mention is minimum wage and living wage. Many people are working two jobs, are working night shifts, and there is a correlation between sleep deprivation and overeating. So those are the two public policy things I wanted to mention.
Sure. I've known people who've worked night shifts and overnight shifts and found themselves gaining a lot of weight.
Yeah. So sleep is restorative for our bodies. So when we don't sleep enough or sleep is fragmented, or one of the issues with the high school kids recently is the kids are getting up too early, that they don't get restorative sleep and there's an increased risk for people carrying extra weight. The classic is the nurse at the hospital that's been working night shifts for 30 years who unfortunately is at higher risk for, you know, carrying extra weight and in turn actually at higher risk for several different cancers.
Here's a fun email from Bo. The best exercise is a good belly laugh several times a day. Good for more than just physical health, mental health as well, for sure. We're going to go to Allison calling from Portland. Hi, Allison. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, this is Allison. I'm the founder and program director at Own Body Health. We support workplaces in creating a culture that's more conducive to employee well-being. And I was curious if the panelists could talk about the role of the employer in obesity prevention in Maine, and in particular, the role of stress in contributing to weight gain and an inability to lose weight, and also being a trigger for how we might eat that is out of alignment with our goals, overall goals for ourselves.
It's interesting, Allison, when you talked about employers, I thought you were going to say not having pizza at staff meetings and not celebrating with cakes and cleaning up what might be in the machine that you can put a few coins in. But you're talking about stress. What do we know about the linkage between stress and workplace stress and obesity?
Well, stress actually is associated with a number of different health issues, and obesity is one of them. And the caller asked specifically about the importance of workplace support for health, and I couldn't agree more. And a lot of the employers here in the state of Maine participate in programs that encourage healthy activity for their employees, in large part because they want to avoid the medical bills that come with employee absences. And as was mentioned earlier, obesity is one of those things that's associated with a lot of other illnesses, for example, diabetes and hypertension. And I want to mention sleep apnea as well, because sleep came up earlier. Obesity is very markedly correlates with increased risk for sleep apnea, which can make you just exhausted. You awaken in the morning and you feel extremely tired and unrefreshed, and weight loss can really completely reverse some forms of sleep apnea too. So some of the most popular employers in the state of Maine are the ones that have always encouraged a workplace activity, Most of the hospitals that I know have been smoke-free for a long time, and many hospitals as well have walking paths through the hospitals. L.L. Bean's always encouraged its employees to get exercise, and many employers will supply gyms locally or passes to gyms as incentives for their employees. This is a growing trend, and it's a very good thing to see.
Go ahead, Erin.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that. Like Dr. McCann said, healthcare costs are going up astronomically, but there are a lot of things that work sites can do. Because we spend the bulk of our time at work, that can be stressful in and of itself, but it's also for a lot of us meaning that we're being sedentary during the day and we're sitting. But we found a few ways at our own organization to combat that, and it sounds like the caller helps WorkSites with that as well. And one little thing that employers can do is just allow folks to do walking meetings. So if you're doing brainstorming, you don't need to be at the computer necessarily, then why don't you take that meeting on the road, take it outside, or if there's a walking path within your building. Our office happens to be set up sort of like in an O formation. So if I'm on a conference call, I'll take a walking meeting. I might walk with other members of our team. And we also have a policy on the books where a physical activity break of 15 minutes is actually paid. So that's half of the physical activity that you need to get for the day that's already built into your worksite time, and you don't have to be stressing about how to fit in as much gym time at the end of the day or however you get your physical activity.
All right, Allison, thanks for your call. We'll move up to Michael calling from New Gloucester. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Jennifer. I was calling because about 6 years ago, I was about 55 pounds heavier than I am now. And my approach to losing the weight was, one, I took it as it being something that was going to be done over time. In fact, it took me about 2 years to do so. But I found one of the, and probably I think the biggest thing that helped me was that I changed how fast I ate, and that I became much more conscious and aware and ate slower, and realized that I was eating way more than I needed because I was eating so fast. And in doing so, now I eat about a third of what I used to, and I've kept the weight off for 6 years now, which felt really great getting rid of those size 48 pants and being in a size 36 now.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for that practical tip. Is there something you do? Do you put your fork down between bites or something like that to slow yourself down when you eat?
No, not really. I just try and be more aware and just I'll chew slower and just kind of take a slower, I think the biggest thing is just being aware and being conscious of what I was doing and realizing that I was shoveling food in and stopping and slowing it down, enjoying the flavors more, enjoying what I was eating more.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for calling in. Peter, you like that advice?
I think Michael's way ahead of us. At Maine Health, we are expanding the Let's Go program to adults. And in doing so, at Well Adult Checkups, we're asking the providers to do a questionnaire, which has about 10 questions. The 10 questions kind of circle around a couple of questions about sleep, a couple of questions about eating, distracted eating, obviously a couple of questions about activity, you know, what do you do, how often do you do it, a couple of questions about beverages, you know, what do you drink, how often. And at the bottom of the questionnaire is, you know, what one thing. So acknowledging people are very busy and have lots of competing demands, what's one thing that you can do to make a difference in your health? On purpose, the questionnaire is not focused on weight. It's focused on lifestyle and activities because, as he said, this is a slow process over time. You're not going to lose 50 pounds in 2 weeks, but over 2 years, absolutely. If you keep up with the efforts and the changes you're making with regard to your sleep or with regard to your eating or with your activity, you will see a difference.
Email from Robert. It doesn't help that the government subsidizes corn, making corn very cheap. Now everything is made with high fructose corn syrup. The government again and again tells us the wrong things to eat, from the four food groups to my period to my plate. It keeps changing and changing.
This is a really common complaint I hear all the time from the public about recommendations that change. And it is frustrating. For example, this year, recommendations about treatment of high blood pressure changed and caused a little bit of an uproar. But the fact of it is that information grows and studies contribute new information, and our attitudes should change over time if we gain more knowledge. And I want to, if I can just segue to that very point and pull in a previous caller's comment about stress, I just also want to highlight the problem of obesity in children and the fact that children are stressed too. It's not just adults, and one of the new things that we truly understand better all the time is the impact of adverse childhood events known as ACEs on adulthood obesity. And what we know is that not only are rates of obesity increasing in adults, but they're really increasing in children at a very, very rapid rate. Childhood obesity is strongly correlated with obesity in adulthood and additional medical problems. But what we now understand is that really traumatic events in childhood can really predict a child's inability to maintain a normal body weight, along with many other health factors that can occur after childhood. Mm. So stress all through our lifetime can have an impact. My husband is a pediatrician, and he takes care of kids in foster care. Girls in foster care tend to be much more obese than other children who are on Medicaid, so they have the same income, family has the same income level, but the children in foster care are typically much more stressed, and they tend to have much higher obesity rates.
Mm. Well, we do have to take another break, but before we do so, we want to have a word about Monday's program. We're going to learn about kidney disease, from diagnosis to treatment to what happens when you need a kidney transplant. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainpublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Highland Green of Topsom, proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow beginning at 1 p.m. on Maine Public Classical.
If you listen to the way New England is depicted in TV or movies, you'd think we've got one accent with some variations, but take a closer listen.
I guess that Sherry didn't bother to start my car.
My father sometimes hides his boots by the road in a park.
Pat laughed and laughed at the merry sound of the shouting.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll dig into the way our region talks and the imaginary lines that divide us. I hope you can join us.
That's Next, coming up at 2 o'clock and about 20 minutes after Maine Calling, here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public has two summer positions available for college or technical school students who are interested in careers in news, journalism, digital news, and or technical broadcasting fields. Candidates should ideally be attending an institution based in Maine or have an existing connection to the state of Maine. Application deadline is this Monday, January 29th. For more information, visit mainepublic.org and click on About and then Careers, or contact the Human Resources Department at 207-330-4506. Again, that's 207-330-4506.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, addressing the epidemic of obesity in Maine. Joining me today, Peter Ammon with Maine Medical Partners and Scarborough Family Medicine, Dervilla McCann with Central Maine Healthcare, and Aaron Gay with Healthy Androscoggin. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Aaron, of all these programs that have been started, why don't you tell me about one or two that you're really excited about, something where you've really seen a difference?
Sure, yeah. We just did one recently called the Smarter Lunchroom Makeover. So staff from our office partnered with the school nutrition director out at Tripp Middle School in Turner. And they did a project that's based on behavioral economics. So the research that shows that the way that you place items or price items will affect what people choose. And so what they did was the school nutrition director added more fruit choices to the lunch line. They used more decorative bowls to hold the fruit. They put it more at eye level and at the front of the line. They also moved where the salad bar was. So Previously, kids at this middle school had to leave the checkout line in order to go to the salad bar. But nobody wants to, you know, have to wait in line longer, right? So kids weren't choosing salad. They reoriented the salad bar to be part of the lunch line. And so far, the school nutrition director has found that more kids are choosing fruit as a result of these little changes that they made.
Isn't that interesting? We're going to go to Rich, who's calling from Standish. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen. How you doing?
Great.
So about 34 years ago, my wife was pregnant with our son, and my weight gain matched hers. We were cooking ribs. I was eating for three while she was eating for two. And after my son was born, she lost her birth weight in about 6 months. It took me about a year and a half. But the way I did it, and I love the comments about conscious eating because that became a part of my regimen. But I put my Walkman headphones on and walked for about an hour every night.
All right.
And listened to NPR News.
Well, so you got smarter and thinner at the same time. but Peter, Rich is a little unusual. I mean, most people don't find that exercise alone is going to do it for them, right?
Right. So, you know, the old adage of eat less and move more is not exactly true in the sense that people have to eat and drink fewer calories to lose weight. Exercise in and of itself most of the time alone does not provide a huge amount of weight loss when they've looked at long-term studies. Exercise has a host of other benefits, including decreased risk of depression, decreased risk for diabetes and heart disease, improvement in arthritis, even improvement in migraines and fibromyalgia, as well as decreased risk for certain cancers, which is unusual but true. But most of the studies show that adding exercise to diet only produces about 3 pounds extra weight loss over the course of a year during these studies.
Mm-hmm. No, but probably what Rich was doing, an hour of walking a night, if he did that 7 nights a week and it's 3 or 4 miles, we're talking 300 or 400 calories burned every night, 2,100 calories a week. So that
right.
You could see how
over
an
time,
hour.
That's excellent. Yeah. So yeah. The other thing that he wasn't doing while he was walking was probably sitting in front of the television eating. So it was a double benefit.
Is that true, him. Rich? Thank you. Thanks for your call, Rich. We have a fun tweet. Heidi on Twitter. Show reminds me of the time my mom had me carry 2 10-pound bags of potatoes around the grocery store, only not to buy them, have me put them back. She said, now imagine if you lost 20 pounds of body fat. She's fun at parties. It sounds kind of mean, Heidi, but the analogy, I think, is apt. We're going to go to Kate in Freeport. Hi, Kate. Go ahead.
Hi. I heard about the SNAP classes, and I'm familiar with them, but I also wonder about the lack of home economics being taught in schools now, maybe at the 8th grade level or 9th grade level, because I think then cooking, how to actually cook food as well as how to budget, have nutrition, so there's a financial literacy piece that gets added in there. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is Erin. I think that's absolutely true. I think there's so much pressure now in our schools to be fitting reading and math into the curriculum that sometimes things like home economics get dropped. And unfortunately, you know, knowing how to cook is such an important skill that maybe people aren't learning at home. So I think that's why these programs are all the more important. And we've really got to be thinking about the basics that we need to give our kids to make them successful in the long term.
We'll move to Randy calling from Augusta. Hi, Randy. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you?
Great.
Hey, I've been a type 1 diabetic for 54 years. I'm 60. And I'm finding that because of the artificial insulin impact on fat retention, I'm finding it very difficult to lose weight. I am extremely well controlled with an A1C of 6.8. And my diet is fantastic. And I go to the gym 5 days a week. So, I'm looking for advice. What do I do next? Oh, by the way, I'm 238, 6 foot.
That's a tough one. I mean, I think it sounds like you're doing everything right. As a cardiologist, I've long ago lost touch with the latest and the greatest in diabetes control. But I think one of the things you're experiencing is the fact that diabetes is actually a very complex metabolic abnormality. and the therapies are very good. And you sounds like you're a very healthy 60-something-year-old. And congratulations on doing such a good job of controlling your diabetes. I can't answer the question about whether or not specific different types of insulin are more or less effective at impacting your, you know, the distribution of body fat or weight loss. So my best advice is to go to someone smarter than me, your endocrinologist, who will probably be able to answer that question.
Good luck, Randy. Oh, go ahead, Peter.
No, I think one of the points I was thinking about when he asked that question was medications. So lots of medications can increase our weight, including insulin, including other medicines we use for diabetes, including a lot of antidepressants and antipsychotics, even over-the-counter medicines like Benadryl, medicines like Neurontin and things like that we use for lots of different conditions. And I don't think we as doctors and people as patients kind of understand the risks of increasing weight from these medications that we kind of use commonly.
Mm. Randy, good luck to you, and I hope your endocrinologist can help you. We're going to go to Karen in Portland. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Hi. I was hoping to hear a little more about the set point. I just read this book called The Secret Life of Fat, and it was so depressing because it talks about people who get overweight, and they can continue to lose weight, but their body keeps wanting to go back to the heavier weight. And the woman that had this problem, and she basically now lives on like 1,000-calorie a day diet. She eats her big meal at 3 o'clock. She fasts for 12 hours. What can a person, because that's my experience. So, you know, I was a chubby kid, lost weight, gained, lost clothes from size 6 to 16. What can a person do who struggles with this issue of not being able to keep weight off?
Okay. How do we trick our body into ignoring that set point?
So it's hard to fight nature, but I think the efforts that you're making and that other people do make can make a difference over time. So the on-again, off-again diets where people lose 20 pounds, gain 30 pounds, lose 20 pounds, gain 30 pounds, obviously ends up people at a higher and higher set point, and your body kind of wants to be at that rate. What you've done, it sounds like, is you've had a very low-calorie diet, which has helped you keep the weight off. And in addition, you know, people will make sure they're, you know, exercising regularly, making sure they're sleeping well, making sure they're trying to, as best they can, control their stress and not taking medications or doing other things that can increase weight. So it's a very, very difficult issue. And that's why in the short run or even in the long run, about 90% of diets fail because the body tries to get back at that set point. So it takes a concerted effort over time to keep that weight off, which it sounds like you've been trying to do.
Any thoughts from either of you about people you know who have been able to trick that set point? And
I think it brings up the question if there is not a one-size-fits-all diet for everybody, and individual genetic variations and genetic environmental interactions can impact your ability to lose weight. I think as we go forward, these very rare genetic abnormalities that cause childhood cancer, I think, are very helpful to help us understand going forward what are the genetic markers for perhaps different therapies or different diets. And I did mention that the ketogenic diet appears to have some promise because there's something about that diet that makes people not quite so hungry.
Mm. Karen, thanks for your call. An email from Gary. Though I think a whole foods plant-based diet is the healthiest way to get to and maintain a healthy BMI, I tell my meat-eating friends to fill up on vegetables before eating high-fat animal-based food products such as pizza, lasagna, or steak. So fill up on vegetables first, really having a salad first, right? And I've also heard, and what do you all think about having a great big glass of water before every meal?
So that absolutely helps, you know, so filling our stomach with water gets to the point what Aaron was saying, that you don't realize you're full until about 30 minutes after you're eating. And if you can eat the fruits and vegetables and salad first, and then the thing we don't realize is that portion sizes, so restaurants have really abnormal portion sizes, you know, compared to in the past. You know, the portion sizes today are 3 to 4 times what they used to be. Plates that we buy at the store are 20%, 30% larger than they used to be. So sometimes tricking our brains by eating dinner off a lunch plate can actually make a difference. So you eat, you still fill up your plate, you still feel full, but you're not finishing everything on your plate.
All right. Well, there's so many calls we're not going to get to. I apologize to any of you with questions, but we are out of time. Thank you all three for being here today. You just heard from Peter Ammon, a family physician with Maine Medical Partners, Scarborough Family Medicine, and the American Board of Obesity Medicine. Dr. Dravila McCann is Chief of Population Health for Central Maine Healthcare, and Aaron Gay, Executive Director of Healthy Androscoggin. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Owen Manahan took your calls. Owen also produced a little video for us with the winner of our Echo Dot Challenge from the other day. So check out our Facebook page for that. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Monday on the program, Understanding Kidney Disease. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.